There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Try new Pure Leaf Blackberry Iced Tea. Discover a world where unexpected blackberry flavor transports you to a berry delicious place. A world so full of refreshing blackberry iced tea that you may never want to leave. However, you will eventually have to. But take your time. Try new Pure Leaf Blackberry Iced Tea. Visit amazon.com/pureleaf and enter 20 Pure Leaf for 20% off your purchase of new Pure Leaf Blackberry Iced Tea.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Simone Vesner, who is from Birkbeck. Who teaches arts management. And she is going to talk about her new book, which is called Artist Voices in Cultural Policy, Careers, Myths, and the Creative Profession After German Unification, which is published in 2018. So welcome to the podcast.
Very nice of having me. Thank you.
No, it's delighted to have you. This is a really fascinating book for several reasons, partially because of the richness of the empirical material, but also because I think it makes some important theoretical contributions to how we understand art and artists. But before we talk about the book, it'd be nice to kind of put the book in context. So could you tell me a bit about sort of how you ended up writing the book and I guess the kind of the story of where the book fits in your career, because it's got a bit of a history to it.
Yeah, I mean, my interest in visual artists goes back a long way. I worked and lived with artists. My own background as arts manager, as producer, as practitioner, I was working in, with, and around galleries. And my very, very first job after the A-levels was actually as a gallery assistant. And so that interest was focused on first on the institution, and it moved more towards the individual producer in later years. The original idea of the book goes back many, many years. The ideas around the book changed quite a bit. So as a trigger point, I wanted to investigate how visual artists related to German unification. So I wanted to know what happened to them before, during, and after German unification. So it's always been an exploratory study, but the emphasis was right from the beginning on change and how to capture that change. So it focused on originally on the working and living conditions, and then later on it developed into a narrative of transformation. And transformation is understood in the sense that it's an indicator for career interpretation and development. And so it is a longitudinal, it developed into a longitudinal research project, and the monograph is a result of that, what I call now the visual artist cohort study. And that captures career development by interviewing the same visual artist from the same region And so far, I carried out two waves, one at the end of the 1990s and another one in 2013-14.
I mean, that was a really interesting and I guess kind of slightly unusual thing about the book, that you'd been able to kind of have this moment in time where you'd done field work and then go back, you know, in the more kind of contemporary setting. And that's one of the things actually that I think really sort of marks the book out as unique. But the other is this kind of context. And it's probably worth doing a little bit of background on why the German context is interesting. I mean, there are loads of reasons why it's interesting, but why kind of in particular that historical period, the sort of 70 years that you try and chart, as well as the German context as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, so there are several reasons. So the political trigger point, German unification, as, you know, looking at the working and living condition that changed overnight for the artists. So how could artists deal with this? And then this emphasis on change that major political trigger point brings with it. The 70 years, they relate to the lifespan of the artist's reflection about their career. And what is interesting here is that in the first wave, this kind of artist reflection wasn't 70 years. It was about 40 years. It was really focusing on the GDR and the immediately after time after German unification. Well, in the second wave, artists started to include their childhood, for example, in their career development, and that they wouldn't mention that at all in the first wave. So the lifespan is dictated by the artists themselves. So it would be interesting to see if there's a third wave.
Yeah.
What then, you know, what we see then.
I mean, it's interesting that both the kind of, you know, the title foregrounds this artist's voices, but also this kind of, I suppose, is a kind of conceptual thing as well in terms of placing the artist's voice in the text. And I wonder sort of why you sort of felt the need to do that, or what, you know, what was kind of missing in terms of discussions of cultural policy where they hadn't talked about the artist's voice before.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what needs to be considered is also the location where, you know, where this study is based. And Saxony has such a rich cultural tradition. Yeah, I mean, all the bridge artists, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century, they, you know, were very well known. And so you look back at this thriving art scene that still continues, but with it comes a succession of 300 years of supportive cultural policies. So that makes it also interesting, you know, to study just the cultural policies of that particular region. But of course, there's also another reason, a very personal reason, why I chose Saxony, and that is I'm from Saxony myself. So, you know, and I have spent formative years in the region, and I experienced unification there. So I was rather young, but I also went through that process, not as an artist, also not as an artist. So the title, or, you know, why artist voices, of course, it is slightly misleading if you talk about visual artist and then, you know, focus the title on sound. But the main aspect that came out of the study is that not being listened to, or hardly being listened to. And of course, that connects and that, you know, accidentally connect. I mean, the book was, you know, nearly written when the political debate really, you know, focused on aspect of, you know, migration in Germany. And so where you had similar political voices speaking out and saying, why are you not listening to us? So there were the kind of, you know, the study suddenly became very political. And but artists' voices, there are also other reasons. So the mainstream discourse and cultural policy doesn't talk about artists as such. It talks about themes, it talks about topics, for example, precarity, creative labor, value. These are all, you know, topic-based. And it's rarely talked about the individual art producer. And I don't think we should forget, you know, also there's a lot of emphasis at the moment on the audience and on co-production. But the artist is still the main producer. And at the same time, there's also a marginalization of the work of art visible in the creative industry discourse. And as you see how, for example, galleries now hang the pictures, they choose the hanging according to that you can take a good photograph of it, and that, you know, that you incorporate the picture in your selfie. So the work of art has become an illustration for other things, and it relates to new technology and social media use. And in addition to that, the old gatekeepers like the critics, the dealer, the publishers, they are all replaced by large IT conglomerates such as Google, and they favoring participatory approaches. So I felt there is a need to bring the artist back from the periphery into the center.
I mean, we're,
culture policy debate.
We're going to kind of come back actually to a lot of those contextual or circumstantial factors when we talk about the second half of the book, which focuses sort of specifically on cultural policy. But I guess the moment of kind of foregrounding the artist's voice raises the question of how have you kind of gone about this, and how have you done this? And the first half of the book deals with this by thinking about myths, memory, and also kind of, I guess, identity sort of broadly defined. So it'd be good to kind of talk through those three sort of core arts chapters, maybe through the idea of kind of what is myth, and, you know, what kind of myths are important to the artists, before we move on to kind of memory and identity.
I mean, when we talk about myths, we always, or misanalysis, the emphasis is hugely on dismantling the unrealness of its character. And that, you know, you can find in the romantic notion of the artistic myth, lots have been written about that. I approached myth from a different approach, because it comes out of what the artists were saying. Also, they didn't use myth as a terminology, but what they portrayed was very much myth-like. So the myth in this monograph is understood as a certainty, and it's fulfilling a vital function for artists' career development. And as an entity, it's adaptable, it's flexible, it's a flexible cultural value, and it provides an explanation related to success, risk-taking, and individuality of a career in the arts. So it's very much understood as a developmental tool of career progression.
Could you give a couple of examples, maybe?
Yeah. So this, you have the idea of the myth changed, and that comes, you know, now I'm going to focus on this idea of, you know, before, during, and after unification. So that during the GDR, the Art Academy was established as an elite education. For example, only 5 artists were admitted per year. And you had 3 Art Academies, so that makes 15 artists per year. And if you made it, that already elevated you to that being very special. And the emphasis in the Art Academy was very much, fostering that talent and making inherent intuition visible. So the focus was on artistic quality, and that served as a counterweight to ideological pressure, and, you know, accompanied with this idea of self-censorship and the limited freedom of speech. So the other side of the myth, what you have, you know, there's this charismatic idea of the genius and talented and individual is, of course, that of the starving artist. So precarity wasn't played out. None of the artists in the GDR had to starve, but it was played out in ideological terms. So they were starved of artistic freedom. And on the one hand, they were really taking care of the provision of social and financial securities was compared to today really unthinkable. Everybody had a studio. They got when you entered the art academy, you got a scholarship. When you finished the art academy, you got a 3-year development grant, and then you could apply to become a member of the artist association. And that all of these 15 people, they knew right from the beginning they are going to be an artist, and they're going to be an artist for the rest of their life. Of course, that all changed with unification. But this security, this feeling of security and also belonging connected to the idea of artistic quality, that led them to kind of play out the social side of their career development. And during unification, they actually took leadership positions. So the idea of the charismatic artist was translated into politics, and the artist became a charismatic figurehead, advocating social and political change and aiming to resolve tangible and ideological precarity. So the idea of the myth changed in this respect. So, and at the same time, they used unification as a kind of springboard for their career while going into politics. That didn't last very long. And after unification, of course, the precarity or of ideological pressure was dissolved. But other forms of precarity, such as the individualization of risk prevalence and pathology of precarity, such as anxiety, emerged. And so the narrative of the starving artist took hold as a possibility. And the artist reacted to that, that in the way they understood markets. They had high expectation to sell their works of art. But at the same time, art production for market purposes was looked down. And so good art can only be judged by artistic quality and not by the market. And that then feeds into this quest for being special, and that, you know, maintained to become a kind of hallmark of their development. And so myths, this changing character of the myth, provides a rationale for also for professional misfortunes. If you don't sell, you know, you can, if you and you focus on artistic quality that is not imprinted or not carried by the market, you still can develop your career. What was striking that I found the business skills, artists develop business skills, but not within their core artistic ideas. They took on side jobs when they didn't sell well. They took on side jobs, and they called that side jobs. And they kept that separate from the core artistic work. But what they did is they brought their artistic skills into these side professions. So they set up exhibition design companies and then, for example, became curators and curated museums exhibitions with a view of the artist. And for them, they expressed that quite vividly, that they improved these professions, these adjacent side professions. And so there is an entrepreneurial aspect, but it is distinctive from the core artistic practice. So in this sense, MIS fosters a distinction. It protects artistic reputation while at the same time delivers a rationale and acts as a driving force.
I mean, as you were kind of collecting this data, you know, sort of speaking to them, mm-hmm. interviewing them about their careers, their relationships to the market, how things have changed, you know, in comparison to, I mean, from a British point of view, I always call it East Germany, although GDR, mm-hmm. And then to unified Germany. There is this question about memory and, you know, sort of the role that memory plays both, you know, as a kind of structuring thing within their own, you know, kind of careers and sense themselves, but also, and on a sort of personal note, more sort of interesting to me was the idea of memory and cultural policy studies, which you sort of argue has not been a concept that has been, you know, kind of used and explored and is almost something that the book is kind of saying, actually, this is important and you should be, you know, kind of concentrating on this. So I wonder if you could sort of say why memory is important for cultural policy studies. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, you know, give a couple of examples from the discussion with the artists.
Mm. And I mean, the artist understanding of memory, or they in a sense, they use memory as a kind of strategic tool to narrate their career. They structure and they structure the interview because they are narrative interviews. So they use memory and memory triggers certain events that they then portray in their narrative or as their narrative. So they try to structure the interview, and that means also they structure their own narrative with memory. And so what they recollect are lively celebrations of what artists anticipated and learned in and through culture before and during and after unification. But of course also the longitudinal approach of the study forces them to sink in these layers of remembering the past. And what they are very adamant about is that they try to use memory to rectify an understanding being written out of the German history of art. And so and at this point, it becomes political and interacts, you know, with the artist's career development. So memory constitutes, it changes, it distorts at the same time, you know, the identity over a lifetime. And similar to MIS, it provides a reasoning for career development. And it, I think why we have ignored, or not ignored, but not paid much attention to memory and cultural policy studies, memory refers to time, and it positions interpretation in time. It bridges the past to the present and the future, but it has less collective judgment. It's more a personal selection. And it reflects the presence, but gives alternatives to thinking about the present. That is not, when you compare it with history, selective in the same way. And it denies linear accounts, what we, you know, still find in the historical selection process. So memory with this polyphonic nature, you know, and especially the individual memory, interacts then with the collective memory and artist and situates the artist within these different memory communities. I think there's one aspect where cultural policy has done quite a bit of very good work is related to forgetting. And the moment when, so that moment when memory fails and then remembering, the remembering moment is when that is rectified. So we are good in dealing, you know, and asking this question, what has been forgotten and why? And it remains an important topic, but the focus so far was on that forgetting with, you know, the abolition of the slave trade. I mean, it of course, it connects also to this anniversary, you know, and event thinking. But for me, memory is really important because it can unpack, shape, and test cultural values. And from that point of view, the cultural value debate hasn't really connected to a huge extent with the memory study. I mean, memory study is a very rich field in itself. So it's what I would like to emphasize is the plurality of memory that can bring a lot to cultural policy studies. And at the same time, it can also, or remembering can motivate and push for actions, as the artists portrayed in what, you know, how they reacted to the idea of being written out of history, the history of art in the unified Germany.
I mean, we should probably think about that a bit more, actually, because the second half of the book grapples with German cultural policy sort of more generally. And obviously there are different levels because you have, you know, on one hand two nations, but also, you know, individual parts of the two nations and stuff like that. So, I mean, could you give me a crash course in German cultural policy? I suppose that the key thing is, like, you know, where do artists fit in your kind of narrative of German cultural policy?
Yeah, and I mean, you know, talking about German cultural policy is we should really call it cultural policies because, you know, with the responsibility of the land, of the culture, there is that, you know, structural divide that every land can come up with their own concepts. And so for this study, Saxony, you know, is, so it's Saxonian cultural policy. But again, it is part of the wider idea of transformation policy. And that has three kind of, you know, you could divide that in three kind of stages. The first one is when Germany unified. And so you have that the East Germany was perceived as an adaptation process. There was this rich cultural landscape and that had to be incorporated into, you know, from a communist or socialist ideas to a democracy. So it was perceived as the East Germany need to catch up. It's an implied approach to transformation. So in Eastern Germany integrated in something that, what is known and what has been successful. Then there is an understanding of transformation that is more applied. And it doesn't come necessarily from the outside, but it is based on the needs of societal development. And that is interpreted as an imperative necessity of change. And that relates to digitalization and globalization. So these big issues, they are need to be tackled within the whole of Germany. So that's more, it's not necessarily adapting, but applying it. And of course, the third stage is when globalization became real and globalization appeared as a practical term. And that happened, for example, with the migrant crisis. So suddenly it became a touchable experience. And the perception of the artist changed. Well, in the adaptation phase, they are very much at the receiving end. But of course, then with the migration crisis, that idea of changed, and so the artists were giving and they were not finding themselves as the receiver anymore. But again, that's a recent development, and it is actually that part also, it's very interesting, it's not part of that book. So the artists, the visual artists fit into the first stage, the very much the implied notion of transformation.
What does this, I guess, kind of broader canvas of changes in the German system, you know, kind of Saxony, but also the wider, you know, globalization and the kind of transformation of delivery, what does that mean for sort of artists, I guess, as like professionals, you know, as the idea of kind of like artist having a job, because this is where the book sort of starts to gesture towards a conclusion. I mean, and the question that kind of came to mind was like, are artists even a profession? You know, is it appropriate? Because obviously you tell the story of how seemingly we moved from quite a clear set of professional boundaries to these more kind of, you know, entrepreneurial, highly networked, you know, doing things that are like lots of different occupations.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, kind of, are artists really a profession? Is that a useful term?
Mm. Yes, of course. I think if we were discussing it from a UK perspective, that doesn't really, you know, capture what is an artist's life is about. However, in that context, I think it or, you know, in general, you know, it depends on the perspective you apply, and the artist sees themselves as a profession.
Mm. Yeah.
But it's very obvious that they are not classified as one of the professions. In the GDR, you have all the hallmarks of a very functional, narrow approach of the profession. So it's selective entry, autonomous professional practice. There is economic success to a certain degree. There is social reputation given to them. So it is like, you know, the narrow functional definition fulfills the criteria. The artists, the Association of Visual Artists, they regulated entry. They masked a quasi-monopoly using work allocation models. I mean, the artists, they never had to market themselves in the GDR, because the Artists Association of Visual Artists would allocate work.
Mm.
It was allocated on a kind of really equal, fair base. So the artists knew if they didn't have a major work, they would get one the following year. Yeah, or, you know, they didn't have a major retrospective, so they would have one coming up.
Which is a formal cultural policy position, isn't
exactly,
it?
You know,
which affords a particular...
Highly regulated, yeah. But again, they adapted to that. Yeah, and of course that created expectations, and it creates an idea. It also feeds back into their social position in society. And so, of course, after unification, you have the loss of this authority and the sense of duty. I mean, what was maintained was this sense of duty, I think. But what is interesting when we look at cultural policy is this inter-regime thinking that really challenges terminology like, you know, profession. And so, you know, what happened when something developed into a democratic setting, when we are applying a language that is developed in this democratic setting. For the artist, this notion of being an artist seems unquestioned. And of course, that is also, you know, feeds into the idea of professional calling. And so also the interpretation of the side job, adding to the professional profile of adjacent profession, that helps to create these new perspectives. So it's very much the focus that I found is this on this inner calling and not being suited for the outer profession. And without a profession, there is this negation of administration. I mean, Bourdieu has been writing about that. But it is the understanding that administration is something they don't necessarily need to engage with. And so they view themselves as pretty much as researchers, and they position themselves in between the field of time, aesthetics, play, and transgression. But it is not only the, in this sense, the idea of the profession remains strong. But of course, when we look at in the UK, this is all expressed within the notion of professional practice. And, you know, I don't think we hardly talk about profession as such. And that plays into this as well. It is this, what it gives. And for these artists, is this positive spin. They have this kind of optimistic outlook developing their career. And I think, you know, that counts for a lot of people, it counts for academic as well. That there is this, that they are in charge of their artistic development. And this is something, you know, the interventions are powered by the artist. So it's debatable, but that's the understanding. What I found also interesting is that this sense of responsibility, you know, Weber talks about that, that is remains, you know, it came very strongly out during unification, but that remains, that they feel there's a task for them in society and they have a responsibility to that. But again, in Saxony, it's also very closely linked to this idea of the Protestant work ethics. And I mean, Lothar, you know, I mean, that he had his 500th anniversary was celebrated in Germany. He talks actually of that work becomes a calling, and Lothar understood work as, or he kind of made it universal. And he brought it forward as a unifying base for the society. So, you know, he spoke out against this distinction between clerical work and the work of the farmer. And that, in the artist interview, this kind of strong work ethics, I think, does connect with the idea of artistic excellence and quality being, you know, some of them had very kind of structured their day, and they made sure, you know, they spend a certain amount of time at work. They rather talk about work rather than practice. So it's that is all also, and it's difficult to say if this is, you know, because it's Saxony and that's the tradition there, or if it is a general idea. You know, I mean, Weber, you know, was applicant, made this applicable for the whole Western society. I think he didn't just, you know, kind of put it, the idea, and said it's applicable in the German context. I think he even went and looked into China as well at some point to do that.
I mean, that's quite a nice clue, actually, as to the richness of the book, you know, in terms of it's not just a kind of a question of a cohort of artists, but actually it's a book that's, you know, about these kind of very broad themes, both theoretically and also in terms of the history of a particular place and, you know, the kind of broader literatures around things like professionalisation. And I mean, we've, you know, we kind of only scratched the surface, really. We could have talked about, you know, kind of ideas of identity as well as professionalism. You know, there's a set of policy recommendations at the end of the book as well. But I guess to bring us to in conclusion, I'm quite interested in sort of what you're thinking about doing next beyond this. You know, you kind of gestured towards maybe doing a kind of a third moment in the cohort study, but are you sort of, you know, you've had quite enough of Saxonian artists and you won't be working on it again, or are you thinking about doing, yeah, something similar?
No, actually, the richness of the data that currently I'm developing, that, and that relates to, you know, thinking about methodology and in particular about qualitative longitudinal research. This study developed into a longitudinal study. It wasn't set up as that, but that longitudinal approach brings with it very interesting connotations, which I want to explore more. And I think one of the more, you know, in the shorter term project is that I want to find other people who relate to longitudinal research in cultural policy. I mean, so far, you know, it's all about quantitative research. There's very little on what I know of in qualitative terms. And so I want to set up a network that, you know, connects or gives a space for discussions. And of course, in more tangible terms, I'm also thinking of developing then a data bank that can store these long-term projects. So very much thinking about the materiality of longitudinal research. I mean, I started recording the interviews on the tape recorder, and then I switched to the phone. But, you know, this is all what happened in material terms to these data. But there are other issues related to, you know, the whole debate of anonymity and the ethical considerations that actually where our views change over time. And, you know, it changed substantially between the first and the second wave. And if there is a third wave, so, you know, what kind of ethical considerations? I started off with thinking about that blanket anonymity has to be applied to the studies. The artist, on the one hand, they demanded that because they don't want to be identified, and you know, there's all relation to their social positioning in society, to, you know, receiving funding and whatsoever. There are many issues. They are very keen on being anonymized, but on the other hand, they also want to, you know, they want to be known, and that causes havoc when you apply blanket anonymity. So these are all issues that I would like to work a little bit further on. More also in kind of in the longer term, for the longer term outlook, to be better prepared when I would embark on the third wave, but that would not be before 2029-30, and that coincides then with another, you know, anniversary of German unification. But then, of course, very attractive would be that I might need to set up a new cohort. Of course, some of the old cohort will not be around anymore. And then I could do an intercohort comparison, which, you know, is something interesting that can come out of a longitudinal research. But you know, it's a long time until then. What I'm also interested in is this as a policy outcome of the book, a very last thing. I mean, there are many policy recommendations that the stakeholder, you know, could implement. But there's one thing, and that is wasn't touched in by the artist at all, is this awareness raising policies that they would not engage in necessarily new technologies to the extent I'm used to, you know, here in the UK. And of course, that is something that I think would be fascinating to do. And so I'm currently thinking of looking not just at visual artists, broaden out a bit and go into other professions, and looking into craftspeople, and there in particular into weavers. And there's a new project I developed called Weaving Your Way Through the Blockchain, where I want to explore the issue of provenance that is tackled within the arts world, you know, the craftspeople, the understanding is that they sell their stuff and then, you know, then it's gone. But if you are, you know, weaving, you spend a long time, and it doesn't make any necessarily in financial terms, the rewards are not, you know, you can't compare that with the amount of thinking and work and, you know, and crafting you do. But they do care about provenance. And so the blockchain, I think, would be an interesting example to write a specific blockchain to capture provenance of, for example, weavers. And what I discovered being a weaver myself is there are quite a few people with an IT background that, you know, I mean, if you think the first computer was developed, you know, from the punch cards in the weaving. So, yeah. Yeah, so I want that is more kind of, you know, project that I'm working on currently. But of course, if you look at the visual artist cohort studies, there are other applications as well. And for example, countries that might have a unification agenda, such as Korea or, you know, Cuba, and even to a certain degree China, that there might be, you know, those applications. But that, again, you know, is depending on the political situation.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. On this episode, I was talking to Dr. Simone Vesner about artists' voices in cultural policy, careers, myths, and the creative profession after German unification.